In this episode, we're talking about Qigong, both Qigong as a personal practice for the practitioner to cultivate their own Qi, as well as medical Qigong, that is, the practitioner doing Qigong on the patient as a treatment modality. So we're talking to Zachary Louis, who is an acupuncturist, master of medical Qigong, Usui Reiki teacher, shaman folk priest, and teaches classical Chinese medicine in Toronto. And to be honest, I got a little distracted at the beginning, and we started talking about teaching, education, and the difference between TCM and classical Chinese medicine, but we do switch over to Qigong about halfway through. But that first part of the discussion was interesting, and I wanted to leave it in. So, enjoy! But I think that's something that not a lot of students understand, is that if you're teaching, you have to really love teaching. You have to be really passionate about teaching.
You do.
It's like your teachers, they're not in it for the money. They're doing it because they love teaching.
Yeah, and there really is, like, you know, the next generation pieces, right? I know, like, in the States in particular, they had this thing where you guys have been doing it way before Canada had regulation. I mean, we've had regulation only for the last 10 years. So I got into that pocket where it was unregulated, and then it got regulated. So it's like, and that's a unique pocket particularly, because it's like, you get knowledge that no one would talk about ever, because it's clinical experiences. And most of the population here, at least in Canada, specifically Toronto, you know, it's Chinese. So if you don't speak Chinese, you've already lost that disconnect. And it's not that they know English either, right? So having switched our regulations, which are awesome, which, you know, English language speaking, getting that proper knowledge, there is a big disconnect on the generational gaps in terms of how much people could actually learn. So, like, we are starting to see that now, I'm finding. Whereas in my generation when we were schooling, you had that filled, and then there was a little bit of a drop, and a little bit of a drop, but it's been a consistent downward motion. I mean, officially on board, we are trying to match California, we're trying to match everything on those lines, but the quality is a little bit different because it's just boards.
And I know that sometimes people say this about China, where it's like pre-Mao, we had the pure Chinese medicine. And then when the Chinese government tried to standardize it, we lost something. Do you feel like that's what's happened there? That when you're learning just from the old Chinese teachers, you got real Chinese medicine, and now you're losing something through standardization?
I don't know what the word real Chinese medicine is. I mean, my take is, can you get clinical results? That's what it comes down to. Medicine is medicine. So it's like, sure, we can talk about classical Chinese medicine. We can talk about TCM. I've gone through apprenticeships. My family's been doing it for generations. And the thing I'll tell you right off the bat with classics is, when you're talking about those family type of learnings, it's like going to the, like, what is the word specifically? The New England Education Club. You need to know certain things. You have to speak a certain way. And I know, for example, one of my teachers, when I learned off of them, spleen qi, transformation and transportation, right? Like, basic term that we know from Machiocha. The dude quoted Zhuangzi. He's like, oh, dream of a butterfly. I'm like, unless I had some background in that, yeah. Really, it's like, but that was the expectation with some of my teachers. They're like, do you know the Zhuangzi? Do you know the Tao Te Ching? Do you know Confucian classics? If you can't quote this back to me and think in a relational way about these, then you're missing the metaphor. And that's a tough standard to go through unless you're growing up in it. I didn't grow up in it, but I was very fortunate with all the types of teachers I had for Chinese medicine, and my spiritual teacher, Andrea Vidimus, who really helped me understand that side of things.
Do you think that kind of knowledge, not necessarily from the Chinese medical classics, but from the Chinese classics like the Tao Te Ching and the Zhuangzi, do you think having that knowledge is necessary to understand Chinese medicine?
I think it depends on what level you want to play at, right? So it's like, you know, when we're talking about the initial 2-3 years up here, that's entry level, right? So if you want miraculous results, then you got to put in blood, sweat, and tears, as my one TCM teacher said. And no one's going to see you crying in the corner for that, right? Because I know when I did my apprenticeship, it was people, like, they laugh when I say this, but I'm like, I'm dead serious. My Huangdi Neijing experience was me learning Kung Fu Panda and watching Horton Hears a Who, right? Like, yeah, I literally awesome. Broke theses down on that for 3 years and just to understand that essence. And then I went to, you know, a professional Chinese medicine school afterward. But it's like, that type of learning, you don't get anywhere unless it's like through the one-on-one.
So you say you teach classical Chinese medicine, is that right?
Yes.
So what's the difference between classical Chinese medicine and traditional Chinese medicine?
So TCM, as you know, we were just speaking on it, that's the communist version of it. So it has communist metaphors, right? I'm always big on political history because it always influences the type of structures we're in and our thoughts. So classics, you're going with pre-communism where you're saying everything is interrelated. You have maybe a Taoist worldview, a Confucian worldview, possibly a shamanic Chinese worldview. Right. And then obviously there's also Buddhists too that would fall into that sphere. And then you have the communist Marxist worldview, which is everything's materialistic and it's classism. So when we have that whole Chinese civil war happening, what happened? You have a peasant uprising and that got out all the aristocrats and everyone that was educated. They got the hell out of Dodge essentially for that. And they went to Taiwan, Singapore, overseas, and that's where they brought their knowledge. So that's why we see, at least in China, a lot of integrated medicine, right? And I will give it to TCM. It's because of TCM most people are doing Chinese medicine in the world. It equaled the playing field. But I also want to say that it made everything average, right? So this is where it's like, that's not a bad thing. That's not a good thing. It literally brought it out. Everyone knows about it. And the education you get at baseline is average. Can you exceed that? Do I view that as a door to classics? Absolutely. And I don't really separate the two out. It's just how far you want to dive into those metaphors and practical applications.
So practice-wise, there's really not a difference in terms of my diagnosis and my treatment modalities and things like that. It's really just more the metaphors that we use to describe the medicine that's different?
I would say the metaphors change the results, though. Right. So like, for example, if we take the worldview of diagnostics and we cover Wenbing, Shenhanlun, things like that, there's multiple different schools. Now, remember, historically in China, you stuck to one school only, more or less, and you doubled down on that. So this is where TCM is like going to a buffet. And then you get to choose what you want from there and say, you know, I really like steak. I really like ice cream. Maybe I'll have ice cream before all the meal, right? Like you get to have the choice at that point, but you have your general, as I would call it. And then from there, you can specialize or choose your interests based on your personality and your life experiences, because not everyone's meant to do the same thing, right? Based on upbringing and interests.
I guess I'm trying to think of like how to say this, but is there a superior approach? Because I feel like I see some people that they like that buffet style. They like to combine things. They say, I'm going to do a little bit of Machio Chizong Fu, and I'm going to throw in some J.R. Worsley Five Element, and then I'm going to pick some point pairs from Japanese style. Is it better to be like, I'm going to stick to one style and stick to this one lineage and go 1 inch wide but 2 miles deep in this one style? Does that give you superior results?
I don't, like, this is the question. When we're seeing superior results, I'd say, what are your metrics? Is the metric of you working with a client and getting them a chronic issue handled in 3 or 4 sessions superior to other ones? I mean, this is, we got to start at a baseline metric. What are the results you're expecting? And at least for me, you know, I gun for as fast a healing as I can. That's my metrics usually. So with that, you know, if someone else can get 2 sessions and I can get 2 sessions, great. If someone takes 10 sessions and I get 2 sessions, well, that tells you right there what the superior result is. Now, how you get that, I don't really care. Like, I view it like jambalaya very much. So you see what works. Now, I generally tell students right off the bat, you need to stick to a system to understand the thought process. And I use psychology as the mapping piece. So, for example, 4-needle technique, it's been a big thing that's been blowing up everywhere these days because Toby Daly and things like that. And I'd say, okay, how long have people been doing 4-needle technique for specifically? And if people want to work on that, like in our student clinic, I actually literally ask the students, what do you want to work on for 1 month? Because it takes about 30 days for a new neurological habit to hit. So if you can't view the world through that particular lens, you're going to get mediocre results. But if you keep to it and you give yourself a timeline saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to solve every single problem through the back shoes. I cannot use the limbs. That's a hard thing to do. But you will be creative at some point to be like, you know, do I use this? Do I go up? Do I go down? Which way do I use the back shoes to get this result? And you'll start to figure things out like needle order, how that impacts it, or name pairs and all these other pieces. But unless you stick to one system, you're not going to dive into it. So I see in TCM, at least in the school education system, they go through it generally. The way I went through it was, all right, you get Bakshu for 3 months. That's all you do is Bakshu. You want to use Madanyang points? You do that for 3 months. Front move points, 3 months. Face, scalp, whatever it is. I went through every single system for a period of time, and that's all I could view my results through. At that point, you get pretty good pretty fast because you put yourself on high limiters.
So I guess given kind of your shamanic background and your training in classical Chinese medicine, what's your view of the current state of the profession or where it's going?
I would generally say it's a profession, right? Business is business, right? So this is where, on a greater whole, I think what TCM is doing worldwide is great. And then you see its offshoots of Korean medicine, Japanese medicine. I count all in the same family group. And I would say, like, that is getting out there. That's awesome. Now, you know, quality, I've always stated this. I think it's a trade, honestly. So to do a trade means you need to apprentice somebody, because that's when you get the goods. There are excellent books out there, and there's plenty of books, but books are dead, as they would say, right? Because it's, you need to have the immersive experience of things. And a book just doesn't do that. It can do that if you've trained yourself in a certain way, but that takes training at that point to figure out how to hack that. So I'd say on one end, I think it's great that TCM worldwide is growing. I think we are helping lots of people. On the flip end, I'd say, well, I like to see more quality pieces, because even talking to other Chinese medicine professors in the States, you know, we kind of even had a whole conversation around acupuncture specifically, and saying, like, well, what happened to the quality of acupuncture? People don't know sinew channels. People don't know divergent channels. People don't even know their internal channels anymore. And this is your bread and butter as an acupuncturist back in the day. And now we just focus on the primary. So that quality is down. And then we think, oh, we need to use herb to compensate. You know, historically speaking, if you could do herbs and acupuncture, you were one of the great doctors, because they're completely different headsets. So now we have a one-to-one ratio of, okay, this point prescription to this herbal formula or vice versa, but you're not getting those nuances as you did. And if we want to cheat, we have the cheat mechanisms in terms of, oh, well, it didn't work, the herbs will fix it. Oh, the herbs didn't fix it, the acupuncture will fix it. And I think that quality is diminishing, right, as we keep going out. I know there is a big push to get that quality back. However, that is the dilution piece I do see.
I feel like from a school point of view, it's hard to insist on quality and make money from your students at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, business is business, right? So the school tells, like, you know, it's a business model of schools are working for you passing your board exams. Board exams don't care how good you are. Board exams care about you being safe.
Yeah, and so I guess it's like, if we say the quality is going down, what's driving that downward quality? Is it adherence to the boards? Is it that the schools just want money, so they're going to try to appeal to as broad of audience as possible? Is it the students are just lazy?
I always say it's never the students, right? Like, I remember even one student, they're like, oh, like, they're seeing me do things. And I was like, this is amazing. We never learned this. And I'm like, you can't blame yourself. Like, they start beating themselves up. And I'm like, have some self-compassion. It's like, I'm calling you out on this because no one called you out on this, right? And you need to have some self-compassion on yourself, because it's the school's responsibility. If not the school's, it's the instructor's responsibility to have a structure for you, because you don't know better. If you knew better, you may have chose something else, but you didn't, because these are the options presented. So at that point, this is the compassion piece. Now, where do we put the finger on this? I think it's a slew of things. I think we have, one, the TCM historical worldview, where that grew out of a peasant uprising, and then that then went into a revolution that we have the PRC. I think there's that education piece where they're like, what do we do? This is all superstitious. You want to talk about feng shui and astrology and Chinese medicine diagnosis? Why would you ever do that? That's one of the core foundational pieces when you talk about classics and interpreting it through that lens. Then you have a cultural gap and chasm between Chinese people and a Western European worldview. Those worldviews are difficult to bridge, I would say, because, you know, what are the value pieces? Like, you know, I always say to people, if you want to do Chinese medicine, you have to put yourself in a Chinese shoe, right? And not a Roman shoe, more or less. And I always talk about historical development of what is Western culture. And if you grew up in the West, you have some bias around that. That's all right. It's understanding your bias and saying, well, what does it mean to be Chinese? Because this is a culture. These are the metaphors. These are the philosophies I'm growing up with. Does this adapt to my life? Maybe, maybe not. And actually having that question, but most people take it like a shoebox and they're like, boom, Chinese medicine's great. And I'm going to apply all these Western values to it. And it doesn't work that way because it's relational. Right down to the language, it's relational. So unless you're thinking, well, if I do this one movement with a needle, how does this affect all the rest of the needles? Most people ain't going to think that way, but in some ways, because Chinese culture, the language has already built that up. So Chinese people think relationally already. We already see this in the psychology. We see this in the way they do business. Like, that is just a fact. The brain is, through upbringing and nurture, wired differently. So there's that piece. And then finally, you have the schools that are saying, well, it's business. All right, it's business. So I would say it's a slew of all these mixes together and saying, how do you fit in? Because I'd say as long as you're trying and doing one step forward, you're better off every single day, right? So if you're like, well, okay, I have a somewhat Western bias on things. How do I question that? What does it mean to live in a Chinese medicine Chu life, right? Because this gets into questions like, are people comfortable with a Cartesian split? That's, it's like spirit is separate from matter. Well, if that's already a subconscious operating system, then you have to break that down because that's not TCM anymore, or at least that's not CM anymore, right? Because in Chinese culture, there was never that split. Shen can switch into Qi, Qi can switch into Jing, and Jing can switch into Shen. So even things like, I know Machioche is like, oh, Jing's very difficult to like cultivate and bring back. And then I know specifically we're a little bit different Canada where they would say something like, it's near impossible to like bring that up. I'm like, there's medical qigong for that, right? Like, that's why you do what we call the Shen Gong. You cultivate your spirit to make yourself healthier on the matter level. And those bridges can't happen. We say qigong because it's in the middle. So you can go down or up. But we can go top to down, and we can go bottom to top also. So it's like it's cyclical in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't recognize, that we talk a lot about how helping your physical body can help with your mental, emotional, spiritual state. But not a lot of people talk the other way around, that by cultivating your mental, emotional, spiritual state, that can have an effect on your physical health as well.
Absolutely. And I think this is where, again, this is where Qigong usually gives you that door opening. Because, again, from a Western consciousness center, you're like, oh, needles go in, herbs go in. It causes a physiological change. Absolutely, it does. However, if we look at Sun Tzu Miao, the dude has mantras and mudras when you look at his stuff. And you're like, okay, how's this work? It's because he's cultivating the Shen. And the thing is, particularly with him, he's a Taoist priest. Most of the Chinese medicine doctors that were like, these are big people, they're usually priests. So that's a big hint. The other thing is, they're usually governors. So it's not like, oh, we're just doctors and we just come on in. They literally have government positions, or they did at some point. Then they went to Chinese medicine. So this tells you the thinking patterns of what's happening that I think is lacking. Because if you understand the perspective of someone coming from a priest standard, unless you've gone through priest training, which not everyone's meant to do, let's be honest about that.
Yeah.
But you have to at least have some opening to that, where it's like, okay, how does this work? Why does qi resonate in a certain way? What do the mantras do in a certain energy resonance? And how's that practical to my acupuncture needling, for example?
And I think before, when you're talking about wearing Chinese shoes and kind of seeing from that cultural perspective, I think it's kind of funny that you brought up Kung Fu Panda, because I did have a Shanghan Lun Wenbing teacher who would say, oh yeah, if you want to understand Chinese medicine, you have to understand Chinese culture. So you should read Chinese books, Chinese classics, and watch movies like Kung Fu Panda. That's a very good Chinese movie. And we all laughed because we thought when he said, talking about the classics, we were thinking like the Romance of the Three Kingdoms and stuff like that. But he's like, no, Kung Fu Panda, that's a really good Chinese movie.
Well, if you break it down, like, I do character breakdowns with the students. I'm like, you know, I don't know who they hired for this, but this is straight up your Foundations 101 when you look at it. It's like, you know, Shen. Shen turns white in second movie. You're like, I wonder what that actually means, right? It's like, so there's a lot of these things where it's like, you know, first villain in the first one's like Tai Long. You're like, I wonder.
You mentioned apprenticeships before. So if you had a student today who came to you and said, I'm interested in doing an apprenticeship with someone, how would you recommend they go about doing that? Especially if they're not, if they don't speak Chinese or they're not involved in the Chinese community.
Right. And I think this comes down to, first, look for something you want to do in the apprenticeship, right? So not every apprenticeship is going to be equal, right? Because every teacher has different skills. And some teachers are for life, some teachers are temporary, right? So this is, you're not going to know that until you start really working with them. However, at least start with the skill set you want to look at. So they're like, you want to learn sculpt? Find someone that does sculpt. You're not going to go to someone that does 4-Neo technique or 5 Elements for that, for example, right? So find a skill set that you actually want to emulate. That's the first thing. Second thing is, now you gotta say, well, are they being straightforward or are they being coy about it? Like, I think this comes to personal interactions. If you're going to someone Chinese, they're going to be coy about it because that's just in the culture. They're going to be like, well, like, culturally, they're testing you. I hate the word testing, but I've gone through it so many freaking times with Chinese people. And as a Chinese person, I'm like, screw this. Like, no, there's better ways to do this. So they're going to do the test. And I know my original Chinese medicine teacher, I did marketing before this, right? And I was going through a year of that. And then she literally was like, oh, come on in. I literally sat there every single day for like 2 weeks. And then she's like, come back tomorrow. I'm like, how determined do you want me to just to learn a friggin' Qigong movement from you? Like, I didn't even go for Chinese medicine. I went for Qigong, right? So it was a little bit different. And then she got me thrown into Chinese medicine, where I remember my first thought around that was, why would I go to anyone for mud and needles? Screw that. How's this helping me on my self-development of energy work? So I think if you're going to a Chinese person, see how straight they are. Because if you're too direct as a cultural piece, they're already probably going to sign you off. Now, I will play stereotypes on this. If it's a southerner, you probably can be a little more candid. If it's a northerner, you have to actually be very indirect with the way you approach things.
So southerner would be like Chengdu, Sichuan. Northerner would be like Beijing.
Something like that. It's an academic game versus a business game. Like, it's like, you know, you go north of the river, everyone looks at your credentials academically. You go south of the river, it's very much like, well, how much money did you make?
No, but it makes me think of the Kung Fu movie, the original one with David Carradine, where he has to go sit outside the temple in the rain and they keep telling him to go away.
And that's essentially what happened with me with my teacher, right? And then, you know, then you have the apprenticeship pieces where what happens if they're not Chinese? Well, I just say, be straight with them and say, look, I want to learn this and offer something. I would say across the board, you need to offer something. And they got to see what is value to them. Is that money where they're like, okay, for my apprenticeships, I paid for treatments to learn from them. And they said, okay, you want to learn? We'll give you a treatment and we're going to sit you down for an hour and you have to break this down for us, what we did. Right? So at least be willing to put up, right? Like, it's the put up or shut up, my take. It's like, give something of offering. If you're like, I just want to apprentice you because you're such an awesome person, it's time. They're putting out time for you. And, you know, that's time away from their clients. That's time away from their friends and family. So give something in exchange. If you can give something in exchange that they think is worthwhile, they'll probably talk shop with you. But at least be willing to offer that first. So that would be the key piece across any apprenticeship. And then again, you have the Chinese cultural nuances. And if it's not Chinese, then it's just saying like, how can I support you, right? I think that's also another thing. It's like, okay, value pieces of, okay, pay for treatments at least. If not, at least send clients to them. Anyone that would send me clients, I'm going to actually probably sit down and be like, all right, you're helping me like survive. You're helping me prosper and grow. So how can I exchange back? This is like mutual reciprocation at that point. But you have to be willing to put the time in. If you just want to be, I mean, I'll be blunt. You want to be a parasite about things. What do you expect is going to happen? Because, you know, these people, it's time, it's energy, and it's their knowledge that they've learned through experience and whatever they had to pay out to learn that. So be willing to do the exchange.
So let's switch gears and talk about Qigong, because
sure.
I really did want to talk to you about Qigong. I feel like when it comes to Chinese medicine and Qigong, I think of three different things. I think of the practitioner having their own Qigong practice just as part of their own Yangsheng and keeping themselves healthy. I think of practitioners teaching Qigong to their patients is like, I'm prescribing Qigong. This is your homework. Go home and do the 8 brocades. And then third, I think what we sometimes call external Qigong or medical Qigong, as in the practitioner doing Qigong on the patient. Correct. As a treatment. So I guess maybe let's start with the first one. Do you think it's important that everybody needs to have their own personal Qigong practice?
Absolutely. I think this is one of those fundamental pieces. In my opinion, I do view acupuncture and Chinese medicine as a spiritual practice. That spiritual practice is based on energy work first and foremost. If you want to switch to a spirit paradigm, that's a whole different ballpark, and that's going to priest work. But at least we can fundamentally agree on energy work. So if you don't have that as an engine for yourself, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to start taking on your client's issues. If not, you're going to get fatigued, right? So there is a cost on this. And I know some people have, like, I've heard people say, like, there's no cost. You're just so positive. I'm like, no, there's an actual cost. Because if we want to even break it down, it's like your Wei Qi field is getting hit consistently when you're working with people's pathogens, right? So you can be positive all you want. That's that internal Qi boost up. We can use the seven emotions to help with that. But that's still energy being expedited. So I think you do need some sort of practice. It might not be Qigong. Ideally, in Chinese medicine, it would be Qigong or Tai Chi or some sort of internal martial or martial arts. But if you do yoga and it's actually working through your chakras, fair game. If you do Reiki, cool. Assuming that those systems have taught you correctly how to do the energy work.
So is the self-practice of Qigong, is that just about maintaining your own health? Or do you find that it comes through in your treatments? Like, do you get better needling and better de qi if you have a Qigong practice?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's like, one, it's for your own self-cultivation. Right? That's building you up. That's making your life better. And I'm always about life metrics, right? Like, I'm one of those pragmatic people where people are like, oh, we do Qigong for health. I'm like, screw that. Do Qigong and make money. Do Qigong and make relationships better. Yeah. Do Qigong and get a better sex life. Like, you know, do, like, it should spread across the board if it's done correctly. But most people are like, oh, it's just physical energy. I'm like, no, man. Or no, yeah. Do that. Like, there's so much more.
Yeah.
So it does definitely translate into your practice. So, like, when people are like, oh, De Qi, it's like, I hear this all the time where people are like, oh, it matters how deep you needle. I'm like, no, it really doesn't. If I fundamentally understand Chinese medicine at its core basis that says everything is Qi, everything is yin and yang, five elements, this is a training technique to go deep into somebody. Because if I understand how to manipulate the energy, then I don't need to, right? I could do very superficially and get a very strong effect. But that only comes if you do the Qigong. If you're not doing the Qigong, you have to work on mechanical techniques to replicate that. So you'll see that in your diagnostics too, where you become more sensitive and you'll just look at somebody and be like, okay, they walk through the door and this is their problem. People are like, how do you know? Like, you know, I always take pulse and tongue. It's one of those things for confirmation. But students know when they see me work, they're like, how does he know all these problems right with the clients? I'm like, because they walk through the door and I sense their energy. They have a wiry pulse. They have a purple tongue. They have this, this, and this. And I'm like, go confirm me because, you know,
yeah,
I could be bullshitting you. So go confirm it. And then they're like, yeah, dude, you are absolutely right. And I'm like, yeah, because energy and the physical body is an illusion here. Right? If I'm sensitive enough and cultivate myself, I already know what's happening with them ahead of time. But obviously, how much work does that take? That takes a lot of self-cultivation work to get to that level.
And you also talked about doing Qigong as a protective measure and building up your Wei Qi. And I feel like we've talked about this before on the podcast, and people have been asking questions about, sometimes it's just, how do you avoid taking on other people's emotions or other people's energy? Sometimes we talk about actually catching the patient's mm-hmm. problems. That patient comes in with elbow pain and I needle them and now I have elbow pain. And people talk about how to protect themselves from that with that. Some people talk about mantras. Some people wear mala beads or use gems or things like that. But here we're saying Qigong is a way to protect yourself.
Well, again, if we're looking at, like, you know, I understand malas, I understand mantra work, all these things. They are to stimulate energy. Qigong is such an umbrella term too. I could do qi for crystals, like I do qi for malas. The difference really here is, what language do we want to use? Now, I'd say for anything like that, you need some basic things. You need a basic cleansing. That means get the stuff off of you. Then you need a basic shielding practice. Basically, keep things off of you, right? And you should be rinsing and repeating that consistently in your clinical practice. Now, how you do it? Well, again, comes back to results-driven approaches. So I would say I could guide people through things. In my Qigong classes, we do this all the time, right? We have courses online for that for people interested, where, you know, my teacher, Andrea Vimes, has a shape-shifting course that teaches this directly. And that's very deep on Taoist magic side of things, too. Right. So, and we have the podcast that actually explains this in depth about different things for our members. So it's very much like you need a cleansing, you need a shielding practice, and you need a centering practice. So people are like, well, how do I center? Well, I would look at that and say, are you even grounded? That can you even be in your own body? That is a hard question for most people. And I think, at least kinetically, as an acupuncturist, you do need to be in your body first and foremost. As an herbalist, you can be a little bit heady, I think. But as an acupuncturist, we're body workers first and foremost. If I'm sticking in that mindset, you have to palpate, you have to feel. And then how do you actually keep that off? Well, again, there's so many different ways we can do it. I've heard things like, imagine a silk ribbon around your wrist at like PC6, yeah. And it's golden yellow, and I'm like, okay, cool. What does that mean? That's a sleight of mind trick there, as we can see. It means, okay, the chi's coming in and you've blocked it off. At that point, I'd come up with a jerk answer and be like, why wouldn't you just block off your fingertips, peeps? Like, you know, why even get it on your hands in the first place? Right? So there's a lot of ways we can go about it. Now, in traditional medical qigong, they say, oh, build up your wei qi, do the cleansing exercises like tossing or shaking or phoenix shakes its feathers. These are very common medical qigong terms, and everyone does them physically. And they're like, we feel great. I'm like, okay, did you go further with it? Because really, I mean, I'll be blunt, you can take a dump and do a cleansing. It's a physical cleansing, separating pure from impure. It's as dirt as it gets. You can go to the bathroom and do that. So I think it's about understanding what it means as a metaphor and what your intention is. From there, you can do so many different things.
And is there a particular type or a particular style or a particular practice that you would recommend?
There is no real particular style or practice with that. I mean, you can go through the Taoist 5-yin organ set. I mean, that's for a tonification. And that's usually paired up with the 5-organ cleansing set. I think most people will learn that in TCM schools, right? Even doing something like an 8-set brocade. Like, that's my puppy form. That's what I grew up with. That's what I do all the time. If shit hits the fan, that's where I'm like, 8-set brocade, touch heaven, shoot the voucher, all that, right? So...
And I guess that's what I was asking. Is it like, is if we just do 8 brocade qigong, if we do hua tos, frolics of the 5 animals, is that enough? Or do we need some specialized acupuncturist specific form?
I think it depends, really. I don't think there's a specific acupuncturist form. Now, I think, again, going back to shielding, cleansing, and centering, those are the specific skills you need as a health practitioner. Mind you, if you do 8-set brocade every single day, you will be okay for most of the time, but it's how far you want to go with it. I think it goes back to that, where do you want to go on that slider? Because if I just say, I want personal maintenance, I want to be able to treat my clients and just have okay results, or just do the mechanical acupuncture and do the point combinations or do herbs, that's fine. When we're talking about this level of protection, you're going outside of the traditional norm from what most people know. Which means, what? You're probably going to need to meditate, honestly. And I know people are like, meditate? Screw that. I'm like, if you can't focus, how are you supposed to even like feel or sense anything? So there's like, I make people meditate where I'm like, okay, 30 minutes a day, solid meditation. If you can't do that, don't talk to me about the rest of the Qigong cleansing you, right? Because it's the intention again and that focus, that E that we're building. And then from there, then you can start getting visceral sensations of being like, okay, here's a guided meditation of how we can go about this and how you throw negativity away or how you cleanse it off of you.
And then I think sometimes we also talk about prescribing Qigong to the patient as like homework for that, for them to do to get better with a certain problem. Is that something that you do in practice very much?
Honestly, no. The reason why I say this is because I don't find most clients want to do it, right? So it's not that I can't do it with them. I know exactly what prescriptions to give. But when I look at the clientele I generally have, everyone's busy. I mean, you know, everyone's working 9 to 5. Then they want to hang out with their family. And you're saying, well, okay, go do this for 20 minutes. The value piece is not there as a priority. Now, I might have some clients, and I do have clients where I say, this is the meditation. Just breathe this color in, you know, do this particular breath work, do this particular movement to internally massage the organs. And I'll give that to every one of my clients. Generally, though, I find everyone's too busy with their life, and that's okay. Again, it's a priority, and this is where we give them the tools. I think that's the best we can do as a practitioner. Give your clients the tools, whether they choose to use it or not, that is a whole different thing. We're not going to be folded into their pocket and be like, hey, you're not doing your Qigong form, you're not doing your massage, you're not doing your diet. I mean, we work with them where they're at. And I find most of my clients, they're usually entrepreneurs. They're usually very high-level type people. So I know of their life where they're working till like 2 a.m. So them even coming for an hour is a win. For the people that have a little more time and they want to do a little more self-development, I'll be like, yeah, this is the exercise for you and this is how you go about it. So I generally do prescribe it. Do I have the intention to have people do it? No, I really don't. I just put it out there because, you know, as a practitioner, I want to see if they want to take it. We just give them options.
Yeah, because I feel like that's something that a lot of people talk about, and it sounds so good in theory. I've just never had it work in practice.
Yeah, and I'd be saying straight to the point, look at your own experience. I mean, you know, master of medical Qigong, I am. And everyone's like, oh, you do all this? I'm like, yeah, dude, and I'm lazy.
Yeah.
I don't do Qigong every day. I mean, I do Qigong when I teach Qigong. It keeps me going. I might do a microcosmic orbit here and there. Like, I'd still have a daily, you know, energetic magic practice. It might not be Qigong, though, at this point for me. So this is like, if that's not even me, why would I expect my clients to do that? That is a, like, hella stupid expectation. But I see people lord this over as a, like, practitioner ego thing. They're like, you have to do it this way. I'm like, please. Like, I remember even one client talking about a really old school person. They're like, you can't take showers in the winter time. I'm like, what are you talking about? It will cause cold pathogen in you. I'm like, modern conveniences, peeps. Like, I get the old school mentality. However.
And then I guess going on to the third one is, I think I've heard this called external Qigong, but then I think a lot of people say medical Qigong is you can actually have the practitioner doing Qigong on the patient as part of treatment.
Yes, you can.
What's that about?
So assuming the practitioner has cultivated themselves and they have a surplus of Qi, then I hear the next argument piece where a lot of people are going to give me hate mail. I'm like, whatever. But this is where it comes down to, they have a surplus of Qi and they're like, we are going to heal the client. We will heal the client. I'm like, get over your high horse here, peeps. Like, yes, I can help the client heal. But reality is, if they don't make life changes, they're going to revert back regardless. Like, so it's like in the external, they say external qi healing, medical qigong, the practitioner is using their own qi, typically speaking, that they've cultivated to project into a client, and they will use that to augment their acupuncture practice, invisible neo technique, tonifying the organs directly, pulling out the pathogens, all these things. Now, on the next level, you would say you don't use your own energy at all, but that's quite high level, I find, right? Most people will just stay at the, we're going to pull from our energy. I'm like, and this is why you get sick, people. And a lot of practitioners unconsciously, in their ability of wanting to help clients, which is, you know, you got into a profession to help, you want to heal those clients. I find a lot of practitioners without a Qigong background even would just feel that they're drained after their clients because they want to help. That in itself is an energetic link, as I would call it. And at that point, they are getting drained of their Qi, whether they like it or not. The difference is in a medical Qigong context, you are externally understanding that you're going to give Qi away. So the metaphor and context is very different on how your subconscious mind actually relates things. Right? Because if I'm giving you something, there is a barrier to a degree of how much I will give. But as a practitioner that doesn't have that training, you will take it like, oh, I'm going to put the needle in, but you drain yourself of energy and you're like, oh, I got like shoulder problems and the client had shoulder problems. I feel so drained. I feel angry, whatever it is, right? So in medical Qigong, you are using external energy sources, whether it be from the practitioner themselves, heaven, earth, or the room. That would be man or person, and you would funnel that into a person and build up their organs, right? So that's usually in reference to needle technique, herbal prescriptions, all these other things. So I usually say Qigong, or at least energy work, whatever you want to call that, is the engine to any of these practices. And then from there, it amplifies everything you do as a training regimen.
So I guess just to be really clear about this, are you saying that there is a transfer of qi from the practitioner to the patient? Because I guess sometimes the way I think about this is like, if I'm doing massage, it's like I'm using my muscles to manipulate your muscles. But that doesn't necessarily mean I'm giving you a blood transfusion. So is it like I'm using my qi to massage your qi, or is there actually qi leaving my body and going into yours during this process?
I would say yes on both.
Okay. Or is like, or is that too much of a Western way of thinking about it?
Well, I think it's not too Western. I literally think it's very much of degree of intention, right? So for example, we'll use the massage analogy. When you're feeling someone's muscles, right, you can go deep into those muscles or you can go shallow, right? We have different techniques to stimulate different things. And for people that are really like, they're into the massage, you're like, you could tell they're like, oh, go deep. Oh, there's this knot here. How much energy do you think they're actually using to do that? That's intention going into a person. And then you could just do a very shallow massage and it'll still feel good, but there's a big difference on that, right? So I think it depends on how much a person is present and how much the intention of the practitioner is. So lots of people are like, well, I didn't feel any difference. I feel completely normal. And I'd be like, do you? Because there is a subconscious splash happening. Like I do, with my teacher, Andrea Vimis, we both view energy as a metaphor for the subconscious mind. So if we look at like mirror neurons, whatever happens to a person happens to you and vice versa. The difference is when you're in a treatment context, you're trying to bring them up, but they can pull you down too. So there is an exchange happening. It's just, where do you control that exchange? Now, obviously through spiritual practices, qigong, meditation, you start to understand those vectors and you can start controlling them. But if your intention is just to help out, you don't have any control of how much you spill out. So some days you'll feel very tired. I know lots of practitioners do. Other days people are like, I didn't feel anything different, but it was a good day. Everything was positive for them that day. And you got to start looking at the general life circumstances around a person where it's like, okay, you have these clients that are angry and then you start becoming angry. And then you start seeing your relationships become angry because you start mirroring that across the board. So the, you know, I think it's one of those things as practitioners, the dirty secret we say is look at your clients, whatever, like you are the ex common denominator. So you might have a slew of clients coming in and they'll be like, oh, we all have shoulder pain. And then you'd be like, the hell is this? Do I have shoulder pain? Because you are the common denominator. And if it's not a physical one, it's a metaphorical one where it's like, well, do you feel you have too much tension in your shoulders, for example, where you feel like you're holding the weight of the world too much or something like that. So we have these blocks, at least as practitioners I've seen, where people have certain issues and you're the common denominator. You either have a solution to that that people are seeking or you need to fix out within yourself and heal that within you.
So practically, what do these sessions look like? Do you just stand there and set your intention and om a few times? Or are you more dancing around the room doing Tai Chi and pushing and pulling? I guess, what does it look like?
Really, when it comes to those external Qigong pieces, I think everyone has a show piece around it. I think fundamentally, the first thing is you need muscle memory, right? It's like, why do you do Qigong? So you don't have to worry about the muscle pieces. So like a basic horse stance, for example, everyone's like, oh, how do you stand? Now, everyone knows how massage tables work. You drop your hand, you see the proper height, things like that, right? But when it comes to like how you work that table, that's a whole different thing. So when we're working specifically in the piece, you're doing Qigong to get your structures intact. So when you do massage, you do kneel techniques and things like that, you are in a solid physical structure. And then from there, if you choose to do any movements, which are metaphors for the energy to flow, right, literally for yourself, it's not that the client cares. You do whatever you want at that point. You dance, you could do the Tuina technique, you could do Gun Fa, but these are trained techniques that you understand what they mean. So with that intention that you're like, okay, this is blood circulating, this spleen 10 is supposed to cool blood, like, you know, who really cares other than you? Because I could talk to an Ayurvedic doctor and they have completely different worldviews of you. And they still get results. So we are working through those metaphors, ideally, that you have integrated in yourself. So in the practice, it would be looking at things of, one, unconscious competence. Get the muscle memory down. It doesn't matter what the forms are. That could be Neo technique, that could be Tuina techniques, that could be standing, that could be mudras, that could be breath work, whatever, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is, what do you want to do? Do you understand the metaphors? So, like, you know, we might say earth phase, fire phase instead of elements, but it's arbitrary at that point. Like, do you have experience of earth? Do you have experience of fire? If you don't, then you're probably not going to be able to work with that within a person, for example. Because I could look at things and say, well, okay, a person has a red face, so they're heated. Then the question, metaphorically, I would ask someone actually training from me is, how good are you with heat? Because if people are like, well, I hate heat. There's some people that actually hate heat. I'd be like, well, then you're never going to be able to work on that pathogen, ever. So, like, you know, inflammation, things like that, you're not going to be good at. Why? Because you can't work with that until you expand yourself, right? So, for example, I know, you know, as a priest and things, I do exorcisms, things like that. It's like, okay, people say cold and flus, easy peasy, boom, right? People say deep-rooted traumas, easy. You know, the things that, you know, I'm like, oh, I know how to work through it, but it's one of those things where it's like, okay, people have insomnia problems. You're like, well, do you get much sleep? I'm like, I'm a night owl. Good luck with that. I know when I sleep, but look, like, that's a reflection right there. I'm not going to be sleeping, and when I do sleep, but, you know, as a business person, as a professor, doing all these things, it's like, you know, no, I'm not going to be good at insomnia at this point in my life, even though I know how to work with it, right? So it's, I understand that about myself, and I know that's my repertoire. I can still get very good results with that. However, it's not my A-grade results, as I would call it. So from a Qigong table talk, it's like, okay, understand those unconscious metaphors within yourself. Then the next thing is, again, I would say, how is the results? And actually look at those metrics. Because you can wave your hands all you want. It doesn't mean anything's going to happen. Like, I see a lot of people, like, those chi people in martial arts. I think that's the best analogy. Like, I can keyball you and you're going to fall down. I'm
What's that called? Like, Dim Mak or something?
Right. And, you know, Dim Mak, Dian Shui, I've seen it used. It sucks. I've actually, like, you know, in martial arts, we did practice that, right? But there's no thought piece. It's a literal thing where you see, like, there's no placebo effect. It's like, boom, person's down. There's still a strike. And even the Shen projection pieces on that, I'd say, like, yeah, but you have to match metrics to the reality of things. Just because you think you can do it doesn't mean it actually happens. And I think that hurts a lot of people's pride on a lot of pieces. I'd be like, okay, great. So you had this great experience. Can you replicate that? And they're like, no, I can't. Then I'm like, that's a coincidence. We have to be able to replicate things. If you cannot do that, if you can do it, great. If you can do it consistently, awesome. That's a start. Now, can you teach that to somebody? Can you teach that technique to somebody? And if the answer is no, then you never understood it. So it's a replication pieces. But that's where I'd say, like, yeah, it's being present, understanding the body mechanics of where your structure is, understanding your own metaphors of what the energy is, because that will change depending on what you're working with. Now, I'm assuming Chinese medicine, people are going to do Chinese metaphors, but you can use other metaphors too, if that's in your wheelhouse. And then from there, calibration or checking for the actual metrics and, you know, rinse and repeat.
So is the medical Qigong something that you integrate in with the needling and the acupuncture, or is it its own separate thing?
So in terms of when I'm working with clients, it just happens with me, right? Now I do teach that, so that's obviously a different thing. If I'm teaching, I separate them out because, I mean, if people are trying to learn points, you're not going to teach them medical Qigong at the same time, right? So, but in my own clinical practice, it is integrated, and people are like, oh, these are great results. I felt that needle go right through me. I'm like, well, yeah. And it's not, this is, again, going back to unconscious competence, where it's like, you know, I'm using all the points the same way, but I have so much chi when I'm doing this type of work that it just emanates. So the needles become, I wouldn't say magnetized, but they just have that effect already, even though I'm not doing medical qigong on a client, right? So I think there's a difference between the unconscious energy transfer, where I have enough residual energy that I just go through the needles and people are like, wow, versus I'm actually doing a medical Qigong treatment where I'm actually being like, okay, I got to move the Qi here. I got to move the organ pathogen and things like that. So I do separate those out. Those are two different treatment sessions from me, But, I mean, you can see where there is a spillover. One's just more like, all right, I'm consciously taking a medical Qigong approach. One is, okay, it's just you get the benefits from that.
So I've taken one semester of medical Qigong as an elective. And so sometimes I've tried to do this on people, and their response is like, oh, you're doing Reiki. And I actually don't know enough about Reiki to know what the difference is. So what's the difference between medical Qigong and Reiki? Is there a difference?
Oh, there's a big difference. There's a big difference. It's like, you know, again, I with Andrea, we have a 2-year program on a Reiki school. So it's not like a weekend boot camp, and we have Reiki hospital grade clinics and things like that. So I think the first thing is understand that Qigong is coming from a Chinese worldview, going back to paradigms again. So that means it's Confucian, Taoist, Buddhist, or shamanic, depending which one you want to play. When we're talking about Reiki, it is Tiantai or Tendai Buddhism influenced in its metaphors, and Shinto. Those are completely different things in Chinese culture because it's Japanese culture. So the value systems are completely different. And I always tell people, if people want to be a master of medical Qigong or, you know, master Qigong person, go through our Reiki school, because literally in Buddhism, what is the metaphor? The metaphorical goal is, at least in the East Asian context, relieving you of suffering, right? Relieving you of suffering of karma. So that's why there's attunements, because the medical Qigong approach would be, you stand in horse stance for 2 hours and you suck it up. And then maybe you do something, you know, maybe you do a visualization with that at some point after you sucked it up enough. In Reiki, Asui Sensei had an esoteric martial arts background. He did. He was in the circles with things like Wei Shiba, who originated Aikido. He was a Shinto priest. He came from an aristocratic samurai family. He had the background and pedigree. He actually was a priest too, right? So having that background, Reiki, at least Asui Reiki, was the creme de la creme of his life. So he had the Chinese medicine background, or we call it Kampo, and things like that. And he knew the martial arts. And then he literally did a 40-day like fasting. And his determination was, I am going to do this or I will die. I don't really care. I either do this and that's it. So then, you know, dude goes through a spiritual journey. He goes through that homage. And then at some point, he finds out he miraculously has Reiki, where he can touch things and things just heal. I'll tell you right that from a medical Qigong standard, that doesn't happen, right? Because the flow is not there. So when we work with Reiki, it's working with heaven chi directly. And that heaven chi through attunements means your structure is at a higher resonance than what you would get with Qigong. Qigong, on the flip side, is better at physical results, in my opinion, to start, right? So because why? It is earth energy and heaven energy mixing into you being a person, right? Or human. So you get that yin-yang approach with things. And then at the higher levels of medical Qigong, you will start saying, I will pull it down from heaven. I will pull from earth, or I'll pull from the environment directly around me and not use myself as a conduit. In Reiki, you already get attuned to heaven energy right off the bat. That's the first attunement. And then you work through your different levels like earth, man, heaven, because they still use the same premise, but you work through those issues and then you get attunements for every level. So it's like someone's boosted you up and said, all right, you don't have to do a year of practice. We're going to give it to you all in one shot, but we still need to train your skill sets on things. So it's a completely different methodology. You might see that closer in Buddhist Qigongs, I find. Taoist Qigongs are very diametrical in that they don't do attunements. They're kind of just like, figure it out, go to the forest and suck it up and see what happens, because it's about the experience of things. If you're putting yourself in a structure, you don't have the experience, but that means experience of what? Nature. And nature, everyone's like, oh, nature's nice. I'm like, no, nature don't care if you die. Like, so it's a different context on things. So Reiki, I find, again, coming from the heaven energy, it has more of a flow state viscerally, and it has a downward motion effect. Whereas Qigong, you might not have that. I find it's a little more, at least depending on what level you are, obviously. But initially, when people are doing it, it feels like they're pulling it from themselves directly rather than flowing it through, right? And then again, heaven energy has more of a connotation to spirit or yang qi, so you can do more changes in that regard. but they're not as permanent either. That is why we use Chukurei as your first fundamental level on the earth level to figure out physical ailments. Whereas in Qigong, they're like, well, if you do a Qigong healing, those ailments, when they get healed, do physically stay intact better after the healing because it has more resonance to earth. So again, I do view them going to the same place eventually. I just find the Reiki short circuits everything that Maguo Qigong tries to do in a 10-year span to a few years.
Yeah, I was going to say, the way you're describing it, Reiki sounds so much better. It's like I don't have to stand in horse stance while people kick me in the groin. I just get attuned and then I got it. I'm not giving up my own chi. I'm drawing the chi from heaven instead of depleting my own chi in essence. It sounds like Reiki is so much better.
Well, Reiki is a creme de la creme system, but this is where I would say it depends who you're getting trained from. There's a lot of far-fetched things where I've seen in Reiki where I remember going to a healing and it was like, people were like, oh, we're doing Reiki on you. I'm like, this is not Reiki. It has a very different visceral effect. You're doing Qigong and it's gross Qigong. You didn't even like cleanse the energy here. So there's a lot of things with Reiki where I find people like they think they get the attunements. I'd be saying, no, you really didn't, right? And the effects for results aren't there. So this is where, again, it's like, what is, a, like, if you get a proper attunement, absolutely. It's like, and it assumes you're training in the system. So that's why it's like 2-year program. I'm meeting my students there every week, and we're doing clinical practice, and we're doing actual, like, exercises energetically, right? So it is like Qigong in the sense of, like, you do still need to do the work. It's just you get a booster up. But if it's like, oh, here's an attunement, and then you're done for the weekend and you think you're done, I'd say, no, that's not Reiki. Like, traditionally, Reiki was a full system in Japan that was used in hospitals. And I'm specifically saying Isui Reiki particularly, because Reiki is a general term in Japan. Because, like, a lot of Reiki, which we just say is spirit chi at that point, that's like Qigong in Japan. There's a lot of different systems around that. So I'm specifically talking about Isui Sensei's particular system. So what you would expect there is you need a training regimen. So it's easier on one level. It expedites everything, assuming you get the proper training. If you don't, then it's good. You're better off doing Qigong at that point because you know what you're getting.
When you do medical Qigong, or I guess even Reiki, does the patient feel it?
Absolutely, they do.
Okay, so if you're doing it and the patient's like, I didn't really feel anything, is that because I suck at Qigong, or is it because the patient isn't sensitive enough, or did it do something esoteric even though they didn't feel it?
Okay, so this is where I will call bullshit on all this, because I hear this in circles all the time. If there is no visceral result and the client does not feel a difference, you did mental masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So does that have to be a physical, tangible result? So if someone's coming for a physical, tangible problem like a shoulder pain, right? You should be able to fix that with medical Qigong and or Reiki, right? Now, if it's for an emotional problem, they should still feel a subjective difference on that where they're like, oh, I feel so much better after that. If you're getting like these non-answers where they're like, oh, well, I don't know. That means you didn't do your job and you didn't have the skill set, in my opinion.
And so is it, are we measuring it by the result, or should there be some sensation that I feel some chi flowing through this channel, or I feel the arrival of chi at a point while you're doing it?
So I'm very much on the metrics of results.
Okay.
Everyone can have a subjective experience. Many people have subjective experiences. But if the results aren't had, then you are trying to justify things on how bad you are.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I know that's not a popular opinion, but it goes back to, I look at it from a medical perspective. People need results. And that's the standard on any esoterics, in my opinion. Right? So everyone's like, oh, spirituality, there's no results with it. And it just is a feel-good thing. I'm like, no, you know shamans had to call rain back in the day or they died if there was a drought, right? Like, there's a concrete evidence to the material world of spiritual practice, not the, oh, I do om and I feel peaceful. Like, you know, om originally was, it's a Shaivite mantra. That's not just a, I feel peaceful. It's a, I'm clearing the room out, if they understand Shiva mantras, right? So this is, again, there's always tangible results that should be felt across the board, objectively and subjectively. Ideally, you get both. Now, if you get one, then you have to question what happened. So a subjective experience, I would say, like, okay, someone has shoulder pain and you had a slight range improvement, but it wasn't huge. Maybe it was a one, right? At that point, I would say, well, what was the life things that happened afterwards? So maybe their shoulder didn't get fixed, but then they quit their job. Or, you know, they got into a better life regimen after that. Then I would say that's a very concrete result. Even though it was just the shoulder that you're working on, everything else in the life had to switch first, and then the shoulder would fix itself. So again, it's going back to those metrics and saying what actually happened on the table and outside. So I'm very big on journaling and those type of metrics and saying, okay, keeping track of yourself every single day, if not on a weekly basis, for people being like, okay, what happened this week? Because I need to see if any other life circumstances happened if we did it subjective healing. Now, again, I ideally go for both. However, reality is you can't get both all the time. So if you get the subjective experience, you still need to measure it to other life circumstances and to see if that changed it, because that does happen. Healing is complex. It's never just the, oh, I got shoulder pain and that's it. We know that's not it. It could be because they're in a bad relationship. It could be because they are, you know, they have self-esteem issues, whatever it is. So we got to correlate different things. I could say commonly, like, you know, in my experience back in the day, there was a client, right? And they were working on things that are like, oh, we have all these digestive issues. I'm like, okay, cool. And I remember this is in my student clinic days back in the day, right? And this is like, you know, I'm doing work on them. And it ended up that they literally broke up from a bad relationship right after the treatment. And you know what happened? They never had the problem again. So what was the problem? It was a relationship, right? But if you, like, how would I predict that, really? There's no way I would predict that. But it's things like that that happen from actual healing, life changes, whether environmental directly or internally.
Where can we find you? Do you have an Instagram, a podcast? Where can we find you?
Yep, have it all. So, I mean, so Instagram at Master Zachary Louis. That, I mean, I put the master there because I couldn't just use my normal name. So it is what it is. But websites, if people are interested in more of the spiritual and esoteric side of things, you can look at Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. So ddtrh.com. And that's a podcast that I have with my co-host and teacher, Andrea Vitamus, every 2 weeks. That's on spiritual topics specifically. And then for the Chinese medicine side, Qigong side, you can go to Wuji Xuan, so wujixuan.ca. And that is the local side of things. If you're in Toronto area, you want a treatment, or if you want to inquire about online courses like our Qigong public programs, things like that, or our Reiki services, I mean, it's all there and listed. And then if you're looking for more specific Qigong stuff, there's Toronto Qigong with a Qigong .com. And I have a bunch of YouTube videos. I haven't updated it, but we are going to start bringing out things such as a lower Dantian meditation course. And that is directly derived from Andrea Vitamus's direct experiences. It's a funny story with that one, because he's like, here's this meditation. I'm like, okay, let me practice it. Then a few months later, I'm like, dude, you know, I found this in the friggin' obscure, like the Taoist, the Tao Zhong, I found this shit in. And I'm like, I don't know where you pulled this ether information from, but like, I've never really seen anyone talk about the Dantian in that way. So that's why we're releasing a course on that specifically. So, I mean, it's very practical. I mean, I use that to boost up everyone, really, because it's a good meditation, and we run daily meditations on weekdays. So really, I'd say we have lots of content online. Just give me an email if you're looking at zach@zacharylouis.ca, and then I can always talk to you guys there personally too.
Awesome. I'll put links to all those in the description and on the website, so it'll make it easier just to click some links. So if you're looking for that kind of stuff, just go there and you can click on it. All right, Zachary, this was really fun. This was really interesting. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a pleasure.
This episode can be downloaded at podcast.tcmstudy.net/session15. There, you'll also find show notes and links to all the things that Zach mentioned. As always, special thank you to the Patreon members for supporting the podcast, YouTube channel, website, and more. If you'd like to contribute, head on over to podcast.tcmstudy.net and click on the donate button at the top. But that's all for today. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.